Welcome back to RCR Talk. I'm Marie Buskey, and joining me now, Trevor Louder, writer, commentator, and Kiwi in Florida. How are you, Trevor?
I'm doing great, thanks. Always good to catch up, Marie.
It is always good to catch up. And you have written a great number of books, particularly around communism within the political sphere and those the story behind many of politicians in the Western canon. Your latest book is called Comrade Prime Minister. It is about Anthony Albanese. You sent me a reader's copy, which I'm sort of well over halfway through. I mean, I knew Albo was a little bit leftward leaning, Trev, but boy, I really had no idea how deep the tentacles ran. This is a man who was identified, groomed, curated, and then deployed. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Like he was groomed from his late teens to be a leader, to be a stealth communist by some of Australia's prominent stealth communists in their own right. You know, Tom Uren and Bruce Childs and people like that. So yeah, absolutely, he was groomed. He was a little bit like Barack Obama in many ways, and Michelle Obama and Kamala Harris as well. It's very similar.
What I couldn't get over was the humble origins of what was the Communist Party at that time, that and they were literally looking to rebuild. So this was in the 80s. That'd obviously been sort of spanked at the end of that Reagan era by the look of it. They knew they were in trouble. And this is at the time that they identified this kid, Anthony Albanese, from a single parent home. What I was stunned about is how few people were involved at that very, very beginning to, and how it, the movement grew. So just give people an idea of that, because it really is quite astounding.
Well, this is the thesis. This is Lenin, how it works. You know, Lenin took over Russia with 2,000 people, a country of 140 million people at the time. So look, at the end of the 1980s, the Communist Party of Australia, which at once had 30,000 members and was on the verge of almost taking over Australia after World War II through the Labour Party, had shrunken down to probably 1,000 members, and it was on the bones of its backside. And as the communist regime started to fall around Europe, the communists reassessed, how are we going to get any influence in Australia when our name is toxic, we have very few members and very little influence left? What can we do? So they dissolved themselves in 1990 and used about $3 million of Communist Party money to set up an organization called the Search Foundation. It's an acronym. And they set about rebranding themselves a bit like Bernie Sanders as democratic socialists and heavily infiltrating the Australian unions, the left wing of the Labour Party, and the Australian Greens. There was about 300 to 400 of them that started the Search Foundation, probably about 100 who were really, really active. Now they are the dominant political force in Australia, and nobody knows who they are. And they have their man in the Prime Minister's office, and they have one of their members as the Prime Minister's chief of staff, Tim Gartrell, regarded as the third most powerful man in Australia. Plus, they have their woman, one of their members, as the top of the ACTU, the Australian Union Movement. They control a whole bunch of unions. They control the left wing of the Labour Party, and that's the dominant faction now. So they control the whole Labour Party, and they control the Australian Greens. And they are pushing the same communist agenda they had back in the 70s and 80s, repackaged through the Greens and the Australian Labour Party. And Anthony Albanese is 100% their boy, and he's implementing full-on socialism. And God help Australia if he gets a second term, because we ain't seen nothing yet if he's unconstrained.
Well, that was the relationship actually early on in the book. You talked about the relationship between the Australian Labor Party and the Greens, and it kind of in a way mirrors a little bit the relationships that we have here in New Zealand. And
Absolutely, yeah.
from my reading, the Greens really are just the same side, a different side of the same coin, and they're very much intrinsically related. So was there a cross-pollination across the Tasman to the communist movements here in New Zealand? So because they appear, from seeing another short that you made, documentary, they appear to come up together at the same time.
Look, 100%. Look, Sue Bradford, who was with the Workers' Communist League and then a prominent Green, the Workers' Communists who were Maoists, they're pro-Chinese radicals. Well, Sue Bradford set up a foundation in New Zealand, modelled on the Search Foundation in Australia. There is cross-pollination. Some of the New Zealand radicals have moved across the Tasman, become part of the Search Foundation. They coordinate their work. And that work is basically influencing the Greens, which they pretty much control, and the left wing of the Labour Party to and as I wrote, when Jacinda was in power, I put out a video on her radical Marxist background and Chris Hipkins on his radical Maoist background. See, one of the main things the communists tried to do in Australia was their recent voice referendum, which would have given the Aboriginals, controlled by the communists, made them the most powerful people politically in Australia. Well, what have the Maoists been trying to do with the Maori in New Zealand? Trying to increase, to give them a protected constitutional status over and above everyone else so they could implement their revolutionary program through them. Well, that's exactly the same tactic they're using with the Aboriginals in Australia. You see exactly mirrored exactly the same way with environmental policies and other you, what the Search Foundation is doing in Australia is being done through the Greens and the left wing of Labor in New Zealand as well. They're probably a little bit more advanced in Australia in some fronts, a little bit more advanced in New Zealand in some fronts, because New Zealand has a much bigger Maori population than Australia has an Aboriginal population, which gives the New Zealand communists an advantage. But the parallels are absolutely there, and the cross ta the Trans-Tasman cooperation is very, very evident.
One of the things that I noticed is that when they came through, they wrapped a lot of these ideologies up in this very lovely, warm, fluffy concept of peace, peace and
Yeah.
love. We're here because we love everybody. And how can you be mean to us because we're here for peace? And the anti-nuclear movement was one that actually helped with them, particularly as we did what we did. So just sort of talk through that, because that I think is how they've managed to slip under the radar for a great number of people.
Yeah, well, look, I had a friend in New Zealand back in the 90s. He infiltrated the New Zealand Socialist Unity Party for our security service, for the SIS. And he trained, he was a good friend of, he was right up there with Ken Douglas, who was the head of the SUP and the NZCTU. And he was in the same Wellington branch as Ken. He knew him very, very well. Ken personally recruited this guy into the SUP. And he was sent to Moscow to train in 1983 at Lenin's Institute for Higher Learning. And that is where they planned New Zealand's anti-nuclear movement. He was there when they did it, when they planned the New Zealand anti-nuclear legislation. And one of the tutors said to my friend John, he said, we have very many brilliant people in the Soviet Union, John, but no one has ever come up with a weapon as powerful as the peace movement. How can you oppose peace? So all sorts of socialist ideas get pushed in the name of peace. The whole goal of the Soviet Union was to destroy NATO and destroy America's alliances around the world so they could dominate the world militarily. So the communists who went from New Zealand to train in Moscow and pushed the peace movement, the anti-nuclear movement through the Labour Party here, they knew full well that the goal was eventual conquest of New Zealand. They were fully conscious traitors. And here's the thing I want a lot of some people to think about. And some people will argue with me on this. They'll say, well, look, you talk about the Soviets controlling the Labour Party's anti-nuclear policies back in the 80s, right? Well, how ridiculous. That was the most right-wing Labour government we've ever had. You know, they privatized the railways, they did all that kind of thing. Now remember this. There was two factions of the Labour Party then, as it always has been, a left-wing faction around Longy and Helen Clark. They were basically working with the Maoists and the Soviets, and the more right-wing faction around Roger Douglas. So a deal was done. The left got the foreign policy, the anti-nuclear, the right got the industrial
Economically,
policy,
yeah.
economic policy. That was the deal. And so, and as Roger Douglas raped and pillaged the public sector, essentially, and I was for most of what he did, but privatizing the railways, removing the agricultural subsidies, and all those workers got laid off. What did the unions do? Nothing. Nothing. Because the unions were controlled by the SUP and they worked for the Soviets, and the foreign policy was important to the Soviets. They didn't care what we did economically as long as we were pushing the Soviet peace policies. So all those New Zealand workers were sacrificed to keep the Soviet peace policies going. And that is the proof. And that caused huge discontent. That's why the New Labour Party got started, because all the union guys, all these left-wing union guys, were absolute disgusted at Rogernomics, and Ken Douglas wouldn't do a damn thing about it, because Ken Douglas was on orders from the Soviet Union to let Roger Douglas do what he wanted as long as we kept the left-wing foreign policy. That's how
So,
they work. They don't give a damn about the worker.
so,
Not a
so,
damn.
it's so interesting that you say this, and I've just gone and pulled out a piece of paper that we discussed in our last interview, which was Yuri Bezmenov and his very famous G. Edward Griffin interview and their four stages of subversion, which are demoralisation, destabilisation, crisis, and normalisation. Now, looking at it in Australian and New Zealand context, the demoralization phase, you know, sort of happened, the destabilization happened. I looked at crisis just when you were saying that, thinking, well, crisis was very much the pandemic. And what you just described during the pandemic was so many people losing their jobs, being mandated out, being treated, workers treated abysmally, and the unions, crickets,
Well,
crickets,
the unions are
Freddo.
actively supporting it. You know, Jacinda Ardern had her Maoist health minister, Chris Hipkins, and the woman who was running the PR response to the whole COVID out of the Prime Minister's office was another Auckland University Maoist. You know, it was a Chinese program. It was to wreck our economy, destabilize us, get us used to being told what to do. Just do huge damage. And they followed the Chinese line. We were living for 2.5 years under Chinese policy, Chinese health policy, which impacted our economy, everything you could imagine. And so we got a little taste of the destabilization phase of communism. And had Jacinda Ardern not become so unpopular and won another term, we would have been the things she would have done with the Maori staff, and that would have just wrecked this country. And a lot of good people would have just got up and left.
Well, they're
And
getting up and leaving now, but
yeah,
yeah.
mainly for economic reasons, I think. But
Yeah,
yeah,
primarily.
you got to understand that communists are very subtle. They will allow you to have a free market economic policy for a certain period of time, as long as they can indoctrinate your kids, as long as they get their left-wing foreign policy, as long as they can use all your foreign affairs money to fund revolutions around the Pacific, as long as they can do all that. They don't mind that certain business people make some money and whatever. That's okay. They have a much longer term purpose in mind. And that's why they don't get in and just go full communist the first term. They've got to do everything they can to indoctrinate the kids and change the systems, leave the economy roughly in place so you don't scare the horses and drive all the business out now. And that's what Albanese is doing in Australia. That's what Helen Clark did. Helen Clark kept a lot of Roger Douglas's economic policies, but she destroyed our strike wing and our air force. We got no air force now because of her, because that was what the Soviets wanted. They wanted to demilitarize New Zealand. And so she did that. And because we're still making money, we accept this kind of thing. So they do what they can, with what they have.
So let's cycle back to Anthony Albanese. He started having some ones. He, got very much involved in the machinery of the Australian Labor Party, and they had some ones around nuclear. They had some ones with some of their other policy. The Voice referendum, was that a case of they were believing their own rhetoric within their own echo chamber, so therefore they thought that they were a shoo-in cobber that was not going to be a problem, that was going to get across the line, and they actually really didn't read the room outside of the Canberra bubble?
That's 100% right. So the Voice referendum was a referendum that would have given Australian Aborigines a special constitutional place and veto power over parliamentary legislation. So can you imagine the power that would have given them? But it wouldn't have given the Aborigines that. It would have given a small clique of leftists manipulating the Aborigines that power. And so they proposed this referendum, completely originated from the Search Foundation. It was a 100% communist policy, not even 99%, 100% from the Search Foundation. They tested it. They were getting like 60% support. 62% support. They thought, we're going to easily win this. We spent a lot of government money promoting it. And just like in New Zealand, with the people rising up against the COVID mandates, they didn't anticipate the freedom backlash. And all these groups in Australia got together and mounted a massive no campaign. And it just caught the left by surprise. They believed their own BS, they thought it was a cakewalk. They were going to, everybody loves us. We're going to support us. And Albanese got his nose rubbed in it. And it was a great win for the Australian people, a great defeat for the communists. But what they're now trying to do is implement it at state level. All the Labor-controlled states are trying to bring it. So they haven't given up on it. The Search Foundation hasn't given up on it. They were defeated in a battle, but the war is still going on. So that's one reason I wrote the book. I wrote the book so Australians could actually understand how deeply Albanese is under the influence of the communists and the implications for Australia if this is allowed to continue.
That was the thing that stunned me. As I said right at the beginning, identified, groomed, curated, and deployed. That's what it felt like looking at that. And then looking across to New Zealand, we have this here too. So when you look at the New Zealand context now, just sort of at that comparison, we have the New Zealand Labour Party, which, as you said, has very deep Maoist roots and Marxist, depending on which politician that you're looking at. We're now having a situation whereby all three parties, the Greens, Te Pāti Māori, and Labour, are sitting on the crossbenches. Now, you're probably not aware, but in a recent poll, Talbot Mills, which of course is the Labour's favourite polling organisation, do their internal polling. They have now shown for the first time since the election that that left-wing bloc would have enough to govern. We've had Waitangi come and go, the usual suspects and shenanigans have happened there. Te Pāti Māori's co-leader, Rāwhiti Waititi, came out just prior to Waitangi Day, and he's calling for a Waitangi Commissioner, an overarching commissioner that pretty much has singularly all the powers that you described were going to be given to Aboriginals during the Voice.
This is exactly what they're trying to do, create new constitutional structures that bypass Parliament and can be controlled by the hard left to implement their policy across the whole nation outside the purview of Parliament. That's what the Voice was, and that's what Te Pāti Māori is proposing. Te Pāti Māori is a hardcore Marxist party. People should have no illusions about that. The Green Party is a Marxist party, and large elements of the Labour Party are also controlled by Marxists. Not entirely, but the Greens are absolutely Marxist. They've always been Marxist right from their foundation. Even the Values Party before them was completely controlled by Marxists. They're not called the Watermelon Party for nothing. They're red in the middle, and they're green on the outside and red in the middle.
Well, they're not even that green on the outside these days, but
Oh
there
no,
you
they're
go.
not. They're not even pretending to be an environmental party. But like, what's the young guy from the Cook Island, young Cook Islander guy who's
Tuiani
this guy, I've got documents. When he went to Cuba with all his other communist friends, he's been a communist his entire life, working with some of the most radical elements on the planet, with very close ties to the Urawera 17 people, who were pro-Mexican Zapatista anarchist Marxists running around the Urawera, getting ready to start a revolution with Tama Iti. And he was right on the fringes of that, but nobody challenges him on that. Nobody, and his friend, the woman who got caught drunk and had to resign,
Oh, Kitty Allen.
Kerry Ellen. It was her and Kerry Ellen were are both on the fringes of the Urawera 17, both hardcore Marxists working with American Marxists, American revolutionaries. But where is the media call out on any of that? Most New Zealanders would have no idea that almost all of the Green leadership is Marxist and have been since the start of the party, from Keith Lock's days, Nandor Tank Shoss, all of those people. There's been a continual stream of Marxists running that party, and the same, and the Maori Party doesn't pretend to be anything but revolutionaries, and a large chunk of the Labour Party is in exactly in the same framework. And that mirrors what's happening across the Tasman. There it's the Australian Greens and the left wing of the Australian Labour Party and a few little independents. They are all Marxists, and they are in power in Australia and implementing all sorts of radical policies which will wreck the Australian economy. So and basically just the and the key thing I promote, though, is the fact that Albanese's in China's pocket, so is Penny Wong as foreign minister. When President Trump is going to be trying to challenge China in the Pacific, he needs allies. He needs Japan. He needs Taiwan. He needs especially Australia, especially. Well, that's going to be a big problem because Anthony Albanese's on China's side.
Well, they're going to go to the polls. They haven't yet set a date, but I know they've got to set it by the 17th of May. So we
It's
know
got to be
that.
by May sometime, yeah.
So we know within the next few months. Now, I have to admit, I mean, here we are in February. They're leading the run a bit late in terms of announcing a date and sort of leading up to this. Do you think that that's a ploy from him? Does he see the writing on the wall? There's been some very high-profile by-elections that have been lost. The mood is
Yeah.
definitely shifting. The Trump election surely must be sending a clarion call that danger Will Robinson, things are not looking good for the ALP.
Well,
What?
that's right. The voice referendum was a major humiliation. The Australian people rose up like they did in New Zealand against the COVID vaccines and against the politicisation of race. They rose up. They did that in Australia. They are running behind the Conservatives, the Liberal coalition and the coalition opposition right now. Anthony Albanese is sort of a little bit behind the eight ball. His policies are unpopular. The political tide is going in the wrong direction. He's panicking right now. He's panicking. But I want people, when he's defeated, to understand the danger that he poses, the danger that his team poses, because there's a whole bunch behind him just like him. And so that they are out of power for years and years and years, because they are. Anthony Albanese, Penny Wong, several of his cabinet ministers, his whole inner circle. They are all hardcore Marxists and they're all pushing Australia into China's pocket.
So, as we have here with Christopher Luxon, he's getting a lot of flack at the moment for his very soft leadership, and he's being spanked for it in the polls. I mean, I've often described that he's a shiver looking for a spine to run up. I mean, that's where he sits. Peter Dutton. Now, where does he sit if he were to be elected in May? Is it going to be a strong sense of leadership now for that centre-right bloc, or is he going to be like a Luxon clone and a little bit flexible and blow with the wind?
Yeah, look, I don't expect him to be a Donald Trump, but I do expect him to be a lot tougher than Luxon. Like, I think they understand more fully what they're up against with Albanese and the dangers, and China looms larger for them than it does for many New Zealanders. You know, they got a basically East Timor, 90 miles from Darwin, is now becoming a Chinese base, effectively. They are more worried. And they're already talking about setting up a Doge department in the Australian government, you know, modeled on what Elon
Elon
Musk.
and yeah.
So I think there will be a big shift. I don't know if it'll be quite on the scale of Trump, but it'll be a lot more so than Scott Morrison or someone like that. And I really wish Luxon would see the writing on the wall. See that people around the world are lapping up courageous leaders like Milei and you know, and Trump and Maloney and others, that this is the way to go now. And just trying to be middle of the road, like, you know, like a new Keith Holyoake or something, you know, just not offend people. Yeah, this is not the way to go. You know, when Luxon wouldn't support David Seymour's bill on the you know, on the basically the scams around race, he just misread the public, something terrible. You know, how could he even think that was a smart move? So what I'm hoping is we'll get a conservative in Canada this year, Poilievre, again, and that'll change turn Canada around. I'm hoping we get a change of government in Australia. See, if Trump's got a friend in Canada and a friend in Australia, that's going to help him so much against the Chinese in the Pacific. So much. That's why the Australian election is so vital, not just in economic terms for the New Zealand trade relationship and all that, but actual national security terms. Because if Australia starts to take a stronger stand against China, I think Luxon would lean that way. But if Australia continues down the pro-China road under Albanese and becomes more in China's pocket, Luxon's not going to make a stand. You know, what happens in Australia is going to very deeply influence what happens in New Zealand in national security and economic terms going forward, which is why I'm putting all my attention right now on that Australian election. I just think it is so critical that Albanese's gone and people understand why and the danger he poses and the actual communist direction of the left wing of the ALP. People have got to understand that. The Australian Labor Party has got to purge its left wing if it's going to remain a relevant party.
So then, is there a chance of that British American style populism actually showing itself in either Australia or here? I mean, we saw a hint of it, I think, at the last election with New Zealand First.
Oh, look, absolutely. Yeah. That
Yeah.
was Winston Peters became the vehicle for that sentiment. And I think a lot more, you know, a lot more people supported that sentiment than actually voted for Winston Peters. You know, they still voted Labor, they still voted the traditional parties, whatever, but they liked what Winston was saying. And they were happy that he got across the threshold. You know, they liked it. And I think that sentiment's only going to increase, and especially it will increase if we have a change of direction in Australia and Trump really challenges China and the Pacific, I think a lot of people will be emboldened. I think a lot of New Zealand politicians are too gutless to take on China, to be honest. They're either making money with China, or their donors are making money with China, or they just don't want to draw too much of a lightning rod to themselves because they don't want to get the Anne Marie, I've forgotten her name now, the wonderful academic down in Christchurch who's been challenging the
Oh
Chinese
yes,
for some time.
and she's
Yeah.
she's been the Chinese
Marie
secrets.
Brady. Marie
Yes,
Brady.
yeah,
Yeah.
Marie
Who
Brady,
has
yeah.
been very, very brave, but suffered some persecution for it and some attacks for it. So, but New Zealand is going to have to confront the reality that they either live in a free Pacific or a Chinese-dominated Pacific. And that means we got to stand up on our hind legs and decouple from China and rebuild those alliances around the world with the free nations that New Zealanders have fought with for generations. You know, that's got to be going forward. That's what we have to do.
Now, nature abhors a vacuum, and if you do start creating a bit of vacuum when you're pulling away these influences of Maoism or Marxism in the political sphere, sometimes that can leave things open to a globalism or a technocracy. One of the hot topics down here at the moment is this genetic engineering bill that was initially drafted with Judith Collins and has now been handed over, I think, to Shane Retty, is now the new minister in that area. What sort of threat do you think that will be? Because I've discussed with someone else from GE Free New Zealand, John Carapet, and we've talked about the effect of that brand of genetic engineering or GMO type products out in the marketplace and the influence that that has. Do you see that as sort of a threat? Is their influence coming in from places like China over those? Because they wouldn't give a monkey's, I would have thought, of whether or not a product is GMO or not.
No, I think this is, and I think this is largely is also driven by big agriculture, you know, like the Monsantos of the world and that sort of thing. And I think New Zealand would be much better place to reject that and really foster traditional agriculture, more organic agriculture. I think that's where New Zealand needs to go, not tarnish our image with GE crops. You know, I'm sure there's people who want to make money out of it, the people who sell their grandmother to make a few bucks, etc. But I think it's a big mistake to allow that, especially like in the United States, the big agriculture works in collusion with the health authorities to so deceptively label things that the labeling laws mean nothing. You know, you think you buy this is an American product. All they have to have is 10% of American added value to call it an American product. It might have been made in a sweatshop in Thailand or whatever, but it's an American product. And they do that with the same with the food stuff. So they disguise everything. They disguise the seed oils. They disguise anything that might alert consumers to the health problems. And that's why I'm so glad that RFK is in there and is aware of these issues that may be able to do something effective about it. But I think it's a big mistake for New Zealand to go down that road. I'm not a greenie by any stretch of the imagination, but I do love traditional agriculture, real food. Like you, we had a garden when I grew up. We didn't have any pesticides in it. We were all healthy. And my dad was hunter, was a hunter, and everything that we didn't eat got buried in the garden, and we ate it, you know, coming through the vegetables. And so that is the agriculture I liked, and organic. That's more the brand for New Zealand rather than allowing GMO stuff in here. Why would you do that? What is the advantage?
Well, that was the question that I had, Cubano. Who benefits? Because I just simply can't figure it out. And especially when you see that this issue was the catalyst that that helped topple the Helen Clark government back in the day. I mean, who can forget, what was it, Seeds of Distrust and the Nikki Hager book all around GMO corn? I mean, Corngate was massive. And here we are. I was like, haven't we learnt from that
You know,
first time.
why are you committing political suicide over this? Why would you do that? You
Yeah.
know, when you're all promoting clean, green New Zealand on one hand, and then you're taking big political risks pushing this. The only thing I can think of, this is the massive influence of big agriculture, which is then, you know, using the World Trade Organization rules, etc., to say you cannot discriminate against, you know, products from other countries, etc. Well, when we sign up to those things, we think it's all free trade. No, it's signing up to a whole bunch of rules that then can be enforced on us and destroy our sovereignty. And I would very much like to protect New Zealand's food supply, thanks very much,
Yeah.
and New Zealand's good name in agriculture, thanks very much. And I think pulling out of the World Trade Organization might be just about as beneficial as pulling out of the World Health Organization.
Well, I don't get to dust off my tinfoil hat very often, but in this particular instance, I looked at the timing of it. I mean, the bill was released in December. It's 17th of February is the date closing for submissions or feedback on the bill. I mean, everybody knows that New Zealanders check out from the 20th of December until Waitangi Day. You know, I mean, we're in Operation Kiwi summer holiday and we're not thinking about
Yeah.
anything. So the timing of that already sets alarm bells for me. Then
Well, of course,
five.
that's a slipping under the radar bill, you
It
know.
is a, but also
Not
to
a full bill.
the timing on the basis of the American election as well. I wonder, are they slipping it under the radar to get it passed, to get it set for New Zealand so that by the time RFK gets confirmed and all the confirmations happen in the United States, that they're actually able to use New Zealand as already set up as a testing ground for these companies to test all of these things out, to do a proof of principle, to then go back to the world and say, well, but New Zealand are doing it.
They're so clean and green. They are like, if New Zealand will accept this, well, why shouldn't we? They're the cleanest, greenest place in the world. Yeah, I'm sure there probably is an element of that. Yeah. And I'm sure this is driven by big agriculture and the World Trade Organization. And why we would be stupid enough to do it, I cannot figure. There's just influence going on that I'm not near enough to know about. And, I'm sure a lot of journalists aren't bothering to find out about, but yeah, there's many suspicious elements to this. But the bottom line is, why would you ruin your image over something like this that it carries no great advantage? They'll say, well, it's going to make it easier to trade with other countries. Well, yeah, we can trade cheap GMO crap, or we can trade high quality value added products, you know, from a you know, with a great reputation behind it. You know, what do you want to do in the long term?
Indeed. Well, the book is Comrade Prime Minister, all on Anthony Albanese. Now, is it released? Because of course I got an author. Oh, there it is. There it is in its hard
There it
copy. Look
is.
at that. Look
Yeah.
at that. Yeah. It
I mean,
is. It's
pretty
riveting.
well.
Honestly, I was riveted. Trevor, I mean, you only sent me a copy a few days ago. I'm already 60% of the way through it. It's a ripping read. You've got, what I love about you is you have all the receipts. So imagery, emails, everything is there. Everything is referenced to where you're at. So if you're an Australian listener and you sort of have always wondered, it was the history and the depth and the backstory, and that there is no, this was not an overnight success. This has been propagated for a really long time. And you outline that beautifully. Where can people get that from?
Well, it's available on Amazon internationally. I'm marketing in America, I'm marketing in all around the world, but I really want to, especially the Australian and New Zealand markets. And it's selling very nicely in Australia right now. I just did a big interview in Sydney with Chris Smith the other day that went very well. So just go to Amazon. I get it on Kindle, you get on Kindle audio, but especially the paperback, which is the biggest seller. So it's just look for Trevor Loudon, Comrade Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's 40-year alliance with Australian communism. But Trevor Loudon, Comrade Prime Minister, will bring it right up. And I promise you, as you say, Marie, I'm proud, very proud that I've made it a very readable book and super well documented. This is my tagline. If If enough Australians read this book, Anthony Albanese is screwed. If Australians don't read this book, Australia is screwed. So that sounds a little bit arrogant, but I think it will make a lot of difference to a lot of people. And people will finally understand how the left works in Australia, how the communists work through the Labor Party and the Greens to implement policies that would be never accepted if they had a communist label on them. Thomas Mayo, the voice of the voice, the man who campaigned across the whole country, nobody ever called him out as a member of the Search Foundation, as an actual Marxist recruited by a Communist Party member. But he paraded across Australia and nearly changed the constitution. Linda Burney, the Albanese's Indigenous Affairs Minister, deep Communist Party background, but nobody ever says this.
Do you
So
think
that's
that
why
that's
people have to understand this and read the book.
do you think that that's because that's part of that normalization? That for so
Yeah.
many people, that what's wrong with that?
Yeah. All these extreme things that would have been extreme. Well, look, you see this with the transgender movement, right? Th 10 years ago, it was an extreme out of there thing. Now, until Trump came along, it's almost you're starting to accept it. You're starting to, well, it's sort of normal now. That's what the normalization means. The revolutionary process is implemented and people give up and accept it and accept it as normal. And well, we got to live with socialism. We got to live with 80% taxes. We got to live with indoctrination of our kids because that's just the way it is now. That's just the world as it is. That's the normalization that comes after the destabilization and the demoralization. And the demoralization process has been going on in Western countries now for nearly 100 years.
And we've seen that process, I know, with a lot of farmers here, with the entire climate propaganda that goes on. Now, if you'd caught our last interview, which Trevor and I caught up in regards to the inauguration of Donald Trump and how things are tracking with the new administration up there, and one of the things we talked about on that interview and the interview previously is Trev's concerns around Tulsi Gabbard, and I can just see behind you The Enemies Within, which I think is the book that you highlighted some of the
No,
areas. Was it that
was it?
one? No, was it that one? Which one
No,
was
it was
it?
White House Reds was the
White
book
House
that
Reds. There you go. I knew it was something like that.
had a whole chapter on Tulsi. This was 4 years ago.
Yeah.
You know,
So
so
if you heard either of those interviews and you're thinking, and like me, because I'm quite fond of, as I said to you, I'm quite fond of Tulsi Gabbard, but my interests were because she crossed the floor on women's sports. So I was looking more
yeah.
through that lens. If you want to sort of get both sides of the story, this is the important thing, isn't it? Is having a little look at things. So that White House Reads, which also you obviously find on your Amazon profile as well.
Yeah, but yeah, White House Reds have got Tulsi Gabbard right on the cover. Yeah, but look, you don't come to a country. I'm a Kiwi, and I'm talking about Australia. And I'm like I talk about American leaders, you don't come to a foreign country and tell them the leader is a traitor working with the Chinese unless you have the evidence to back it up. You wouldn't last very long, would you? So, I do pride myself on very heavily documenting my work, and I commissioned a whole bunch of research in Australian archives. I got all these old documents that have never been seen before, incriminating a whole bunch of people in this. So I think you'll agree, Marie. I do make my case pretty
You do.
strongly,
You do.
and people can challenge it, but I think they're going to have a real hard time challenging this. Look, Tim Gartrell, Albanese's chief of staff, is a member of a Marxist organization, a revolutionary organization, the second or third most powerful person in Australia. And who knows this? Who knows this in Australia?
So I don't know whether you caught. Comrade Jacinda has just she they won an award at the Sundance Film Festival for the documentary. I could feel the eye roll from here, Trevor.
Yeah.
And of course the new book is out. The new book is out because she leads with empathy and kindness.
The hagiography, the biography of the saint, Saint
Yes.
Jacinta.
So
I'm just wondering,
when
the Pope to canonize her. That must be.
Oh, I know. Don't they have to be dead first though for that? Anyway,
Well, they can.
I digress. So when are you going to look at writing? I know you've done a couple of documentary short films, which are fantastic, and you can find those on YouTube around some of the links that we have here in New Zealand. When are we going to have a Anthony Comrade Prime Minister style book on what happens in New Zealand? You know, and I think you should call it I See Red. That's my suggestion.
Well, I used to have a little show, and I used to play the split end song. I see red, I see red. It's a cool title. Actually, I used that, and copyright got in the way, unfortunately. But I am planning a book on New Zealand that will deal with some of the things we've talked about in the last couple of interviews. I think New Zealanders need to understand how deeply the communist movement has changed the country. Completely under the radar, and is still changing the country today, even under national governments sometimes, but more so under the left-wing governments. But what happens is the left gets in, changes things, national gets in and doesn't change things, just keeps the status quo, usually, and then it goes back, it just ratchets to the left all the time. And so I do plan a book on New Zealand, and I'll probably come back and tour it. But I'm really spending the next, and I may go to Australia and do a tour there too. But I'm really all my time between now and May is pushing the Comrade Prime Minister because it is so critical for the Western Alliance. It's so critical for New Zealand, my home country, and it's so critical for the Aussies that they wake up to this guy and his team, and they have a very good chance to turf him out of power and to start a Trump-style revolution in Australia. There's a good chance to do that. And I'd like to contribute in some small way to that process.
Excellent. Hey, look, this is Trevor Loud, and the book is called Comrade Prime Minister, available now on Amazon. As always, Trevor, thank you very much for your time and joining us today on RCR Talk. I'm Marie. Thanks, Trev.
Always a pleasure, Marie. Thanks so much. And hopefully we'll meet down in Kiwiland at some stage in the near future.
I look forward to it.
Okay, thanks, Marie.